Hello and welcome to this first and possibly only Insight podcast marking the launch of Insight's second phase. I'm Gráinne Fáler.
And I'm Louise Holden, and we're here with Insight's new CEO, Professor Noel O'Connor. Noel, we've loads of questions for you. I hope you're ready.
I am indeed, yeah. Delighted to be here.
Good. Okay, so we're going to kick off with this. How are you feeling about stepping into the role of CEO?
I think I'm very excited overall. I think it's a very exciting time for the organisation. It's our first relaunch on foot of being very successful in phase one, and we've been working hard over the last 2 years to get to this point. And I think our hard work in the first phase of Insight has been recognised and rewarded by Science Foundation Ireland with the award of the funding for phase two. And that's enabled us to do very exciting things like put in place new research structures, new EPE structures, new business development structures. So it's a very exciting time for the organisation.
What's your vision for Insight?
My vision for Insight is that over the next 6 years, we will become recognised as a world-class research centre in the broad area of data analytics. Beneath that, world-class scientists in each of the individual research challenges, but also recognised as being more than the sum of its parts, so that we have inter-site, interdisciplinary collaboration right across the centre, really making Insight the go-to place for people wishing to do visionary research in this area.
Okay. Can I ask, how has Insight changed from phase one into phase two? Like, how do you see that first section of its development, and where do you see it going? Like, how is it going to evolve?
I think it's worth reminding ourselves that at its very outset, Insight was somewhat of an experiment by the department and by Science Foundation Ireland, by the IDA, to bring together everybody in Ireland who's working in this discipline under one banner, within one research centre. Something of that scale and ambition had never really been attempted before. So there's a long bedding in period, I think, over the first phase of the centre's evolution, where people had to come together, had to understand each other's research, had to learn to be able to work with each other, had to understand what our joint and joined up proposition to industry partners was, for example. And that takes time. I think we've been very successful in that over the last 6 years. What the second phase of Insight has allowed us to do is to consolidate on that, to redefine our structures. Specifically, I'm talking here about our research programme, to move away from siloed research group to cross groups in each institution, to cross-cutting research challenges across the organisation that bring together researchers from multiple different subdisciplines within data analytics and from different universities, all to work on a particular research challenge in the broad area.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you've been involved in Insight since the beginning. Were your thoughts evolving on how that kind of collaboration might be achieved? Because obviously there's a geographical split between the sites, so that's an instant challenge. How do you think that can be overcome in Insight 2?
Everyone talks about collaboration in research. In my experience, it's probably one of the hardest things to achieve, at least meaningful collaboration. In a sense, it has to come from the ground up. It can't be collaboration for collaboration's sake. That just never works. And it has to be a meeting of minds between the various different researchers who are collaborating, right? So they're both coming to it with equal interest and mutual benefit in terms of getting something out of the collaboration. So you can't have a scenario where one researcher is quote-unquote in service or providing a service to another researcher. It has to be deep and meaningful for both of them in terms of the research that's being carried out. So that to me is more of a barrier than the geographical distribution,
right.
Quite honestly. I think we've got to the point now where our communication tools, you know, like Skype and Zoom and Google Hangouts or so and so on, are sufficiently slick that they enable geographical distributed collaboration very effectively. So I'm more focused on trying to identify where those nuggets of crossover can happen within the research programme that bring people together and get people genuinely excited about working together.
Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously a lot of the work in Insight is driven, or hopefully will be driven, by industrial demand or collaboration for relevancy and also for funding and various other reasons. That in itself, there's a peril in that, because if you want your research to be taken seriously, you don't want people throwing the accusation that this is just, you know, you're just pandering to the market. So how do you balance that?
Yeah, I think it's hugely important that we always keep that in the back of our mind, and we protect the core of Insight, which is the fundamental research, which after all will sustain us into the future. Mm. And if we were to let that go, or to under-resource that, or to see that shrink, then we'd be in real trouble. Maybe not in the next 3 to 4 years, but definitely in the next 6 years, definitely in the next 10 years, right? So it's extremely important that we nurture that core of fundamental research, and balance that carefully with the need to go out and pull in industry partners in large-scale research collaborations. I think we're lucky in this area, data analytics, machine learning, AI, because in actual fact, I believe that industry can really help inform our research. There's a lot of hype and talk about and excitement about AI, as there should be, and its potentially transformative effect on society. Mm-hmm. But very often what we still find is that we take these techniques out of the laboratory and try to deploy them in practice, they tend not to work as well as they did on the academic data sets, for example, right? Mm-hmm. And that's very interesting, because that provides insight into where they're not working, why they're not working, and how they might be improved. And that can then feed back into the fundamental research in order to us to progress the state of the art, progress the techniques themselves, refocus our research on areas that are particularly important in terms of the longevity of the research. So you can have this kind of virtuous cycle of innovation between industry and academia. And that's what we'll be trying to stimulate with our industry partnerships, to ensure that the projects that we're doing with them ultimately feed back and inform our basic research, and it's not just working with an industry partner for the sake of meeting an industry funding metric, for example. It has to be interesting research that feeds into our longer term research agenda.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the role of the public as a sort of third pillar of this, there's a lot of talk about the idea of involving the public in research design in order to ensure that the things that are being worked on in an academic setting are actually needed or desired in society or can actually help people. Mm. So you're not just producing stuff for its own sake and then it goes out there and people are like, why did you bother? How can that be done? That's obviously very challenging, even accessing people that you can bring into that process.
It's very, very challenging, but I would say it's hugely important. So education and public engagement is taken very, very seriously in Insight. We're lucky that we have a really talented, enthusiastic and motivated EPE team, which we've now bolstered going into the second phase of Insight with a dedicated EPE committee, which representation from each of the individual sites, each of the individual research challenges and from business development, so that we have a more holistic view around education and public engagement. And it's not just a small team within Insight working on that. It's woven throughout the fabric of the organisation. That's how we're setting ourselves up, to try to have a platform to ensure that we have a very strong education and public engagement programme going forward. Mm-hmm. Practically, we're looking at putting dedicated resource behind this to make sure that these things happen. So we have a very exciting initiative that we launched in September at our scientific plenary meeting, where Denise McGrath, the chair of our EPE committee, announced a call for proposals for citizen science projects. Mm-hmm. Across the organisation. We got great response to that, and we currently have proposals out for review under mm-hmm. that programme, and we hope to be announcing some very exciting citizen science initiatives at our upcoming launch in December.
Can I ask, actually, so this came up from the Insight members. Kieran Moran asked, to what extent will Insight to be actively engaging the general public in its research, from research direction and design to user needs requirement and final quality evaluation? Now, to me, having seen the completely excellent work that the education and public engagement team do, that is one strand of public engagement. But what Kieran is talking about here is another strand. And in a way, it almost feels like sometimes a trick is being missed in Irish research, where there could be an opportunity to bring the public in, or to bring even if people are proposing to do a research project that might help a particular group or assist a particular group, to actually bring those groups in and establish that there is a requirement and a need for the research that's being proposed. Is there any plan for that?
I think it's actually been happening already in Insight, but to a limited degree, perhaps. So if you think about all our health-related projects, whether they be set in clinical environments or just general wellness projects, I mean, the first phase of those projects is always engaging with stakeholders to understand what the actual needs are before we go off and do any research or develop any technology. Mm. And then we always try to bring that back, albeit in a very limited way, through limited trials typically, to validate the technology with the people people who were informing the design of that technology in the first instance. And we have multiple examples of that. Ciarán's own project, the Pathway Horizon 2020 project, and our targeted project with Aqueous BI are two notable examples where we follow that exact, that cycle and that loop. It's not appropriate for every single project, I would say. So you can't really impose that structure on every single project, but it's more appropriate to certain areas than others. But we would hope to see more of that as we continue our health-related research into Insight Phase 2. I think the other area where we could do more in that respect is in the whole area of smart cities, smart communities. Mm-hmm. We're starting to see the early shoots of that with the Enable SFI Spoke, where we have a very strong programme of citizen engagement. How do we accomplish that? We actually have funded people who will sit in Smart Dublin as part of their role within Insight, as researchers within Insight, and through that mechanism interact with the public through the various existing established forums for citizen engagement through Dublin City Council. The hope there is to grow that activity in that particular space, and there may be other areas where that becomes appropriate as well. But not every research project will necessarily need this. If it's a very bespoke piece of technology development, well, then it may not need widespread citizen engagement before the work starts.
I wonder, as the communication side of things, we are lucky to get to talk to researchers a lot because we're trying to bring their stories out. And, you know, we get excited hearing about the projects and, you know, diving into them and talking to the researchers. Is that something you ever get an opportunity to do?
I try to make time to do it. I don't always get enough time to do it, to be honest, for a whole variety of reasons. I love talking to people about my own research in particular. Every year I carve out time to talk to the first year engineering students, for example, to give them a high level overview of what we do in very simplified terms, to explain to them that there's a lot more that goes on in a university than, you know, undergraduate study and the social side. There's this whole other world called research happening, very often invisible to them. I also try to get out to one school per year to talk to the students and talk about a career in STEM. I find it's a nice break from the normal CEO duties.
Of course. And when you talk about your own research, how do you describe it?
My research is in the area of computer vision, content-based information retrieval, machine learning and AI. And in a nutshell, I try to explain to people that it's about teaching machines, computers, to try to perceive the world around them using cameras very often, as we do as humans. Mm-hmm. And then if you can get across that basic concept, then it becomes very straightforward for people to wrap their head around the technology underpinning, you know, self-driving cars, for example, or how Facebook are analysing your images and so on. Mm-hmm. I think you start with that very simple analogy of we as humans take this for granted. Mm-hmm. This is very challenging for a machine, but it turns out over the last 10 years there's been so many technological advances in different areas. We're now at the point where machines can nearly do it as well as humans. Right. And that, I think, really excites people, enthuses people, and really, you know, sets their imagination free in terms of where this could all lead to ultimately.
Right.
And
we get actually on that, like, we got a couple of questions about your research. Like Brian Caulfield was wondering what your first big break in research was. Can you recall that?
My first big break in research was running, and I sometimes wonder what Brian's talking about. Was he talking about results, or is he talking about papers being published or whatever it might be?
Yourself, like, what would you know, where did you see, okay, maybe this is that created your path for you?
So in my PhD was one of those PhDs whereby I tried many, many, many things that didn't work, and I went down many, many, many dead ends to the point where I nearly was despairing of ever finishing, quite honestly. And then I happened upon a paper by some researchers in MIT who were working in a similar but different area. And I decided to have a look at their technique and see what they were doing. I implemented their technique, but it was back in the days when people weren't sharing their code and you couldn't really reproduce, you know, their technique directly from their paper. So I ended up with something that was different but more adapted to my own research, and suddenly I was getting fantastic results. And from that point on, it was a sprint to the end of my PhD. And so I sort of a message to any first year or second year PhD students out there is don't despair. It's a marathon, not a sprint, until the very end when it becomes a sprint. But there's a long period in there where you have to explore, you have to do a lot of things wrong, you have to get a lot of bad results before you actually figure out what you're actually doing that's contributing to your research area.
Okay. And Linda O'Sullivan was asking about your proudest research moment. Would that have been the same, or did that come later?
My proudest research moment. My proudest research moment was probably the graduation of my first PhD student, because it was the first, and it was great to bring somebody in and work with him on the same challenges I had as a PhD student, but from the other side of the table as a supervisor, and navigate that course to the point where he graduated and went on to have a great career.
Great. Do you think we're okay to start asking questions from?
I mean,
I've thrown a few in, but there's been a couple of very interesting ones
from the organisation. So we put a call out across Insight to ask people what they really wanted to know about you and your work and your role. And we got a huge response, so obviously people are interested, and it's a good sign for the cohesion of the centre.
Absolutely.
Right, so hopefully people will get some of their questions answered now.
Yeah, we gave people the option of, you know, having their name attached to the question or just an anonymous question. This one actually comes from somebody who didn't want to be named, but it's a good question. The person said, how do you see the role of Insight among the many other funded SFI centres with AI remits? Are Insight FIs and PIs stretching themselves too much and in too many different directions and not leaving enough time and bandwidth to have strategic impact with Insight? In this context, where do you see Insight in 5 years?
Yeah, so I think that's a really, really good question. When I think about Insight's role in the Irish research ecosystem, I always see us at the centre as the hub, if you like, because if you think about it, we are the largest centre, we're the data analytics centre, and data is now at the heart of everything, right, irrespective of which research domain you're in. We also have collected the best of the best in Ireland as PIs and FIs within Insight. So as new strategic areas in Ireland pop up, like advanced manufacturing or like digital content analysis or agri-tech, it's no surprise actually to see our PIs and FIs assume leading roles in those centres or those initiatives. Another example would be the Centres for Research Training, for example, of which 6 were funded by Science Foundation Ireland. These are the new training centres to produce, I think, 700, 800 PhDs over the next 7 years. And of the 6 that were funded, 4 were co-led by Insight researchers. And that's because of the excellence that we have at our disposal amongst our PI and FI base. So we contribute a lot to the Irish research system, I believe, in terms of not just being the hub and the centre of that as Insight, but then assuming leadership roles and kicking off these other initiatives and other centres, which are really, really important to Ireland. I think that's a very, very healthy thing. I think it wouldn't be credible for Ireland to have advanced manufacturing research centres, for example, without a very strong data analytics component, right? And that's to the benefit of Ireland and to everyone involved. In terms of bandwidth capacity and FI bandwidth and capacity, absolutely, it's of concern. And I'm constantly reminding my PIs and FIs that you know, they need to be wary of that. It's very easy as an academic, and we're all very prone to it, to taking on multiple roles in multiple different initiatives, right? And it's always a balancing act. We always find it hard to say no. So I am always encouraging my PIs and FIs to think a bit strategically about if they're going to get involved in a new research centre or a new initiative, how they're going to balance that with the responsibilities they've taken on within Insight, and by the way, how there might be a mutual benefit between those two initiatives. So a great example, for example, is the Vistamilk Research Centre, headed up on behalf of Insight by Mark Keane, and there's a very strong relationship between that research centre and Insight, which I don't believe dilutes either centre. In fact, strengthens both centres, and that's a great model of success going forward, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There was a question that came in a couple of times over the course of that call out from PhD students in Insight concerned about the stipend. This appears to be kind of a universal problem across PhD study, but just the fact that the stipend, it hasn't increased since 2014, 2015, and honestly, prices cost of living, all of that is increasing. People seem to be under a lot of pressure. Do you have a take?
Absolutely. I think this is one of our biggest challenges, the next phase of Insight. And by the way, not just at PhD level, although that's probably where the problem is most pressing, but, you know, attraction and retention of staff is hugely important. And it's very difficult to do that if they're not paid well for the excellent jobs that they do. And that's at PhD level. It's also at RA, research assistant level, postdoctoral level, research fellow level. It's a problem for the entire sector. The challenge here, just so people understand, is that SFI stipulate a stipend for a PhD that's adopted nationally. And that's the same for all research centres. And all budgets for all the research centres are factored based on that allocation of the quote-unquote cost of a PhD in this case, for example, right? So it means that we have a budget that is mapped to a number of PhDs, which itself is mapped to our metrics, our outputs. If we were as a centre to unilaterally decide, if we were allowed to, and we wouldn't be allowed to, by the way, by SFI, but unilaterally allowed to, if we were unilaterally decided to increase that stipend, well, then we would have fewer resources because our budget wouldn't be increased by the Department or Science Foundation Ireland, but fewer resources, fewer human resources to deliver on what we've promised to deliver on, right? So this is a big problem for Insight, but it's a big problem for every other research centre who finds itself in the same bind. What I can say to people is that, you know, we are very aware of it. We're very sensitive to it. I'm particularly passionate about trying to make some progress on it over the next few years. We're talking constantly to Science Foundation Ireland about this, and they in turn are talking to the department because it is a national problem. I can reassure people that every time we meet with SFI, it comes up. We put it on the agenda. We explain what the challenge is. And I'm happy to say that we're starting to see some movement. So there was some positive noises made at the recent SFI summit where it was acknowledged that so this is a big challenge and that they're going to look at it and see what can be done. But it won't happen overnight. Okay. So I suppose that's the best I can say at the moment, is that we've acknowledged the problem. We appreciate the challenges and the pressures people are under. We're doing our best to address them, but it won't be a short term answer, unfortunately.
Okay. On that, and the pressure to sort of produce, or what is the correct term, but produce a large number of PhD students. There was another question that came in that was interesting. It said basically, again, this questioner wants to remain anonymous, but they said the majority of most well-known institutions and research centres with high impact around the globe today impose restriction on PIs regarding the number of PhD students they can supervise at any given time. Are we going to expect this scheme to be enforced at some point across Insight? I assume not.
No, we won't be. I'm not sure I actually agree with the first part of that. I can think of many counterexamples of very high impact research labs in my own research area, where very well-known researchers have very large research teams. I mean, I think it depends upon the supervisor and his or her capacity to supervise. Mm-hmm. There are other factors such as, you know, whether or not there are senior postdocs and research fellows on that team who can help in the supervision load. So I don't think it's as simple as just saying, you know, good research and good impact will occur if everyone only has a small number of PhD students. I think it's a much, much more complex than that. It does, I suppose, hark back to what we spoke about previously about this idea of people being stretched too thin. And that's a key concern, obviously, if people are stretching themselves too thin at PI level, such that the people who are suffering are the PhD students who aren't getting adequate supervision. Well, that's a real challenge, obviously, but there's not a simple fix for that for everyone, right? Because everybody is different and everyone has different bandwidth capacity.
Okay.
I suppose that probably links into Enrique Moreau's question about a bottleneck, if you can perceive one. Is there a bottleneck in the Insight Centre in terms of growth and expansion, and would that be in the area of postdocs, or would it be in funding, or is it an infrastructure, or where do you see it?
I don't think it's in funding. I think we're very generously funded. Our funding allocation for phase two is significantly increased from phase one. So I don't think it's a funding issue. In terms of capacity, I think what's very exciting for things like supervision and so on, what's really exciting in phase two is we brought on a lot of new funded investigators and principal investigators. So there's more supervisory talent in the pool, if you like, mm-hmm. coupling that with our mission to drive cross-discipline collaborations, I would see that overall the supervisory base has actually expanded when you factor in both of those aspects. So I don't see a bottleneck. I think what we do need to do is make sure that we are nurturing talent beyond PhD level, so that people see a career path for themselves beyond PhD, whether that be into academia or ultimately industry, but that immediately after their PhD they have some runway as a postdoctoral researcher, perhaps even progressing to a research fellow. And that's how you build capacity into the system, and that's how you avoid bottlenecks. And maybe there's a bit more we could be doing in that regard, but it is certainly our intention over the next 6 years to ensure that people see that career path ahead of them. Mm-hmm.
Tomás Ward was he put a question about how, given how pervasive data analytics is becoming, how does a research centre specialising in the study of data produce output relevant to every sector which might expect it? And he's asking the question basically, should Insight specialise in a smaller number of key areas in data science?
I think the answer to the first part of the question is domain experts. You know, that's why we have domain experts in Insight. People from physiotherapy, health and human performance, schools of history and geography, the social sciences, chemistry, biology, right? These domain experts bring the knowledge of that particular domain, and then when you couple that with the core data science expertise, then you have something really, really special that arguably neither could accomplish on their own. Tomás has been a great example of that, by the way, with his work with Brian Caulfield, you know, bringing together his knowledge of data analytics and biomedical engineering with Brian's expertise in physiotherapy. And they have a very, very impressive collaborative research program ongoing and ramping up, I should say. In terms of having a core focus or restricting our core focus, I think that's challenging for us because we are a national centre. As I mentioned earlier, data is now everywhere, as Tomás has indicated, and therefore it's not just one kind of data scientist that we need, right? And we don't just need mathematicians and statisticians. We need people who understand natural language processing. We need people who understand LinkedIn and open data. We need people who understand computer vision and multimedia analysis. We need people who do the recommender systems which feed the information back to the end users. So I think we have a healthy mix spanning the sense, analyze, actuate cycle that we're trying to cover within Insight. I don't think there's any areas in there that I would see as superfluous. So no, I wouldn't agree with Tomás that we need to restrict our focus at this point. Now, at the moment, we are in a growth phase. That's clear to say, having brought on new PIs and FIs into transition from Insight 1 to Insight 2. And I think that's healthy. And then maybe over the next couple of years, we'll stop, take stock, and then we may need to consolidate and stop growing and expanding into other areas. But I think at the moment, we're in a very good position.
Okay. Pat Dempsey asked, when it comes to Insight, what are you most proud of?
That's a really difficult question. Thanks, Pat. I am really proud of the journey from Insight 1, you know, 1st of July 2013 to the 30th of June 2019. You know, as I mentioned, I think at the start of the podcast, this had never been done before. Something like Insight, you know, has never existed in Ireland. At the time, I think when we were funded, we were the largest non-capital single research investment in the history of the state. If that's the case, we are still, by virtue of our renewal, at the very least, we can say we are at one of Ireland's largest awards, right? We have performed fantastically, I think, and we have really repaid the fate that the government, the department, Science Foundation Ireland, and most importantly, the taxpayer have placed in us to deliver on what we said we would deliver on Insight 1. So it's very easy to be proud of Insight as a research centre, to be honest.
That's great. That was great, Noel. We'll be back shortly with you to answer the rest of the questions, because we got so many we're going to have to record a little mini-sode after this one, and we have loads. So if your question wasn't answered, stay tuned or just download the second one. But look, in the meantime, best of luck in the role, and thank you very much for joining us.